Syria says the U.S. push to keep a border crossing in Idlib open is aimed at supplying terrorists with arms, under the pretext of delivering aid. Iran launches the clinical trial of a Neder coronavirus vaccine days after authorizing the emergency use of its first domestically made jab. Rival rallies are held in Peru's capital, Lima, amid uncertainty over final results of the recent presidential election. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The Syrian Foreign Minister, Faisal Maghdad, says that the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Idlib aims to supply terrorist groups with arms and prolong the war.
This is another attempt to help terrorist groups and to provide them with all necessary materials to prolong the terrorist war against Syria.
In an interview with RT, Maghdad also said that cross-border activity by the U.S. and Turkey is in violation of Syrian sovereignty. The aid is funneled from Turkey into northwest Syria in an arrangement authorized by the UN Security Council. The seven-year authorization will expire next month. A diplomatic standoff is expected between the Western members of the Council, who support renewing the authorization, and Russia, which has threatened to veto any such move. The top Syrian diplomat called Washington's policy a pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country.
If the Western countries are really careful about Syrian citizens, they should lift their sanctions, because these sanctions and what we call unilateral coercive measures adopted by Western countries and by the United States are killing the Syrian people. They are not allowing us even to import medical instruments, not to mention foods and other necessary materials for the protection of the lives of innocent Syrians.
Maghdad also accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. He said that the sanctions affect 95% of the population. Syria has been in the grip of bloody insurgency since 2011. Idlib is the last stronghold of foreign-backed militants fighting to bring down the Syrian government. Independent journalist and resistant activist Vanessa Bailey says that the U.S. and its allies aim to sustain the terrorist enclave in Idlib, which is effectively run by al-Qaeda.
If we look at the fact that Bab al-Hawar, which is the last remaining crossing that is open, which is completely under the control of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which of course is effectively an al-Qaeda rebrand. And Bab al-Hawar is a well-known trading post for HTS, which means that all of the humanitarian aid which enters Bab al-Hawar is seized by HTS and then sold at extortionate prices to the civilians under their control in the last remaining al-Qaeda haven, which was described as the largest since 9/11 by Brett McGurk. And of course, Ambassador Jeffries, Mike Pompeo's point man on Syria, recently admitted that al-Qaeda is a U.S. asset inside Syria. So it's very clear that the intention by the U.S. coalition to maintain the cross-border operations is to sustain the terrorist enclave in Idlib and to sustain the war against the Syrian government.
Thousands of members of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces have held a military parade attended by Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The event was held at Camp Ashraf in the eastern province of Diyala. The military base was formerly occupied by U.S. forces. It marked the seventh anniversary of the formation of the PMF. Weaponry, including tanks and rocket launchers, were put on display in the biggest demonstration of the PMF's military might. In an address, Kadhimi paid tribute to the sacrifices of the forces in fighting Daesh terrorists. The PMF was established after a 2014 call to arms by Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, to help defeat Daesh. In Afghanistan, thousands of families have been forced to flee their homes in Kunduz amid the Taliban's extended offensive to seize control of the northern city. In our news review program a short while ago, my colleague has discussed that issue with our guests.
Over 5,000 Afghan families have now fled their homes in the northern city of Kunduz as the Taliban forces continue to surround the key city. Officials say another 8,000 families have been displaced throughout the province, this after a month of sporadic clashes between the insurgents and government forces. A new wave of fighting has erupted in the province of Kunduz over a week now, leaving 30 civilians dead and 225 wounded. The violence comes ahead of a planned withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country by this September the 11th. Taliban says that they have seized nearly 90 of the country's more than 400 districts. But much of the claim has been disputed by the central government. Peace talks between the two warring sides in Qatar have also been stuck at a deadlock. And now joining us for the program is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Mr. Nicholas Ayala, editor at Anticonquista, joining us out of New York, New Jersey. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Canada with you, Robert. Your initial thoughts on the story, Rob.
This we're seeing, again, is all the response of the United States. The United States has been at war in Afghanistan for over 20 years, has caused all kinds of suffering there. The United States initially supported the Taliban and opposed the Taliban, and the people in Afghanistan have suffered horribly as a result. Now the U.S. has announced its withdrawal, finally, after 20 years, and the people of Afghanistan will be left to establish a government of their own. It's not going to be easy after 20 years of this war and interference from the United States, but it's what they must do. Whether or not the Taliban becomes victorious and rules the country remains to be seen. But the bottom line is that people are suffering horribly as a result of this 20-year onslaught, and the United States has responsibility for all of it.
That's a good point, Robert. Thank you for joining us. And Nicholas Ayala, I'd like to welcome you to the program now. Nicholas, to Robert's point, and it's a great point, that, you know, regardless how you look at it, right now, okay, there's going to be instability for a while, but initially, ultimately, inevitably, you have to give this country back to the Afghan people. The U.S. and NATO cannot stay there forever. It's arguably they stay there way longer than they're supposed to stay, and possibly they should have never gone in there in the first place. Your thoughts on Afghanistan as we see it and the challenges it has today?
Well, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with Robert that the only people who know what's best for their nation, for their sovereignty, is the people who actually make up that nation, who actually live in those community. The U.S. went into Afghanistan with the hopes of defeating terrorism, and what the result has been is a 250,000 Afghanis dead, massacres not only by the United States, like we saw in 2017 with the Staff Sergeant Robert Bales killing over a dozen Afghanis, including some children, but also what we've seen recently pop up with the Australian soldiers who went in there massacring civilians. What's been the result of this NATO-led alliance of this imperialist aggression led by the United States with the cooperation of NATO has been only more terror for the Afghani people, but not at the hands of groups like the Taliban, but at the hands of Western-led imperialist powers who have terrorized the people, who have massacred civilians, and who have brought more instability, which has benefited their populations, their corporations, right, their elite, who have been able to profit off of this war and make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars through the military-industrial complex, through all kinds of corporations trying to rebuild Afghanistan only after it was destroyed by the U.S. imperialists. And that's been the result of this two-decades-long war. The only people who can fix this situation is the Afghani people and those who are allied with them to actually promote their sovereignty and their national determination.
Thanks. And Robert, can you make the argument that Afghanistan is much more worse off now because opium cultivation as at an all-time high. The Taliban, I mean, perhaps before they might have had, power over a lot more than they possibly have at this exact point and juncture in time. But at the same time, they were against 20 years ago, the opium trade, opium cultivation. And in this last 20 years, they learned to utilize it because they had to to get arms. So they've gotten into the business. They've made the business flourish. They use it to arm themselves and fight back against NATO and the U.S., and not to mention against the Kabul government. But basically, you've made the Taliban stronger than ever. You've pumped up the opium supply there to its peak of more than it's been ever. What have you done for the Afghan people now that you're leaving?
The U.S. government and NATO and the other participants in this awful war have done nothing but make life much worse for the people. As you mentioned, the opium trade is flourishing, and that is causing untold suffering, not only in Afghanistan, but in other parts of the world as well. The things we don't talk about very much, the rate of air pollution in Afghanistan is so astounding. There's fecal matter in the air. There is people are not safe in their homes, not safe anywhere. There has been no benefit to 20 years of war, except, as your other commentator mentioned, to the people who benefit from the military-industrial complex. Some people have made millions upon millions of dollars by this war, and that's all they care about. That's all the United States cares about. The United States government was never concerned about the autonomy of the Palestinian people, their right to self-determination. It just wanted to have a show of force and maintain a war somewhere so that the military contractors in the United States could gain astronomical profits through sales of their weaponry. This is something that has been going on for decades and decades, and Afghanistan is just the most recent and most tragic and longest example of this. But as far as any benefit to the people of Afghanistan, they have received none. Things have gotten much, much worse for them because of U.S. interference.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure to have you both on. Stay safe, both of you, and thank you. Robert Fantina, author and journalist here, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Mr. Nicholas Ayala, editor at Anti-Conquista, joining us from Newark, New Jersey. Thanks for tuning in to News Review program, and bye-bye for now.
Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Iran has launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine, and this is part of the drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. The shot, dubbed Noura, has been unveiled at a public university of medical sciences in Tehran. Officials say that Noura is a recombinant vaccine and can be easily mass-produced after completing clinical trials. The project, sponsored by the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, is the result of 16 months of scientific research. Iran is working on several coronavirus vaccines. Earlier this month, the health ministry authorized the emergency use of an all-Iranian jab called Barakat. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, got the first dose of the vaccine on Friday. Thousands of people have rallied in London in the latest round of protests against coronavirus lockdown measures, demanding an immediate end to the restrictions. Police arrested a dozen people, confiscating items ahead of demonstration, which also protested several other social issues. Meantime, British Health Secretary Matt Hancock resigned following revelations he violated COVID restrictions. This as COVID-19 cases surging rapidly in the UK in light of the emergence of the Delta variant. The country has recorded over 18,000 new infections, the highest daily rise since February 5th. It's also registered 23 deaths. The latest figures push the UK's total confirmed cases to 4.7 million and the fatalities to 128,000. The pandemic continues to spread fast around the world, with the global cases surpassing 180 million. Total number of fatalities is also nearing 4 million. Tunisia has recorded 4,600 cases. That's the highest daily tally. Thailand has announced new restrictions in and around the capital, Bangkok. Meantime, Brazil's health ministry reported over 64,000 new daily cases, with nearly 1,600 deaths. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and the second highest death toll following the U.S. A two-week coronavirus lockdown has gone into effect in Australia's largest city of Sydney. The measure taken by the government is aimed at halting the spread of the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19. Under the new rules, people can leave home for essential work, medical care, education, or shopping. Restaurants and cafes remain closed, while public gatherings are banned and mask wearing is obligatory inside. Meantime, Australia's northern city of Darwin will enter a separate snap 48-hour lockdown on Sunday, this after a handful of coronavirus cases were found at a remote mine. Australia has been among the world's most successful countries in containing COVID-19, yet the government has faced criticism for a sluggish vaccine rollout. Peruvians have held rival rallies in support of socialist presidential candidate Pedro Castillo and his right-wing contender Keiko Fujimori amid uncertainty over final results. Castillo supporters, holding banners and photos, marched in downtown Lima, close to the headquarters of the electoral jury. They were calling for Castillo's apparent election win to be confirmed. A few blocks away, Fujimori's supporters paraded with national flags and banners reading "No to Fraud." Castillo holds a slender 44,000-vote lead over his rival, and this after all ballots were counted in the June 6 runoff. He has already claimed victory, but Fujimori has challenged the results, despite international election observers calling the vote free and fair. Final results have since been held up due to legal challenges. Now that was Peru. Now let's take a look at France. The people there are heading for polls to cast their ballots in the second round of regional elections. The first round results saw a drubbing for President Emmanuel Macron's ruling party, disappointment for Marine Le Pen's far right, and a record low turnout. The results put Le Pen's National Rally Party ahead in just one region. There were also cross-party concerns over the low turnout for last week's polls, which were shunned by nearly 67% of voters. Some observers believe that the outcome of the first round of the elections has raised doubts over whether the 2022 presidential vote would come down to a duel between Macron and Le Pen in a runoff long seen as the most likely scenario. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tell a little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of first grade. My dad, who is from India,
listeners special. We'll be right back.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special, the Sunday program. Of course, on this beautiful Sunday, June 27th, 2021, I'm Atef Erfani hosting this program today. Listeners Special, as you know, is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So contact us and tell us what you think about our programs, because your views are very important to us. Oh, dear listeners, let me tell you one thing. If you have any messages for our dear listeners around the world, then record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back to your program, Listeners Special. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very useful and important to us, especially to our technicians and engineers in IRIB English Radio. You know why? Because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving a QSL card from us. Of course, these days my colleagues are designing and preparing eQSL cards for you and have already sent these eQSL cards to you, dear listeners. And here I truly appreciate and send my warmest greetings and my warmest appreciations to those of our dear listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports. Here I have a list of reception reports, which I mentioned some of their names here. We have reception reports from Abdul Alim from Bangladesh. Konstantin Provotorov, one of our regular listeners, has sent us a reception report. Also, Ratan Kumar Pal from India. Also, like Abdul Alim and Konstantin, one of our regular listeners, has sent us reception reports. So, Abdul Alim, Konstantin, and Ratan Kumar, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And many thanks to those of our dear listeners around the world who have kindly sent us letters and emails, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during the program I will read their nice emails or letters. For example, Hey Mercia, one of our regular listeners from the Philippines, has sent us an email. Thank you, Hey Mercia. Rodrigo Bortolotti from Brazil has sent us an email. Rodolphe Takax from Romania has sent us an email. Sorry, Rodolphe, I don't know your language, but I try to pronounce it some way. Also, Michael Sjöberg from Sweden has sent us an email. Also, I don't know Swedish, and I hope I'm right in pronouncing your name, Michael. And the last but not the least is an email from the UK, and this email is from Richard Cook. Dear listeners, first of all, many thanks for sending us these kind emails and letters from around the world. After a short break, I will be back with these letters and emails. Please stay with us. This is listening. as a special, and I'm back with an email from Hey Mercia, one of our regular listeners from the Philippines. Hey Mercia says, "Dear Sir or Madam, I'm happy to say that I have received your station and heard your program. If my reception report of your program was correct, I hope that you will send me a QSL, but an EQSL will be fine too. Thank you for your time and attention in advance. Looking forward to hear from you soon. Wishing you, staff members, and other people from station success and prosperity. Best regards." And first of all, salam and warmest greetings to you, Hey Mercia from the Philippines, and many thanks for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. So you have received our station and heard our program. Why don't you tell us which program you listen to, and what is your view about that program? Please tell us in your upcoming, in your future emails and letters, what do you think about the programs, the broadcast that you receive the signals. And yes, of course, my colleagues will send you an EQSL card. As you may know, sending QSL cards was stopped after the coronavirus hygienic protocols. But now my colleagues are sending you, dear listeners, EQSL cards. And that's all. We also wish you the best. Hey Mercia from the Philippines, write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Please tell us your views about our broadcast. And from the Southern Hemisphere, yes, from Brazil, we have an email from Rodrigo Bortolotti. Rodrigo says, "Greetings. It is with great satisfaction that I write for this wonderful radio. It's been a long time since I have been listening to your broadcast. I really like the programs. I'm starting to collect QSL cards, so I am sending my reception information to receive your card and the programming bulletin, if possible. I wish the radio direction and all the staff a great week, peace, and happiness. I am 42 years old, and I'm passionate about electronic equipment such as radio and transmitters. I will always be following transmissions of your great radio here in Brazil. First of all, salam and warmest greetings to you, Rodrigo Bortolotti from Brazil, and I send my warmest appreciations to you for sending this really inspiring and encouraging email to IRIB English Radio. And many thanks for your compliments, as you described as radio as the wonderful radio. Thanks a lot. Your compliments, your encouragements really motivates us in our path to provide the best kind of programs for our dear listeners around the world, always updated on unbiased news and the wonderful programs as you described it. So we are so happy that you enjoyed the program. Of course, my colleagues will send you EQSL cards, and thank you for sending us reception information. And so you said you have been listening to IRIB English Radio for a long time. That's great. So tell us which program or programs you like the best, and tell us your views about our broadcast. Thanks a lot. We wish you all the best. We wish you peace, joy, happiness in your way, in your life. Thank you, Rodrigo Bortolotti from Brazil. And you said your hobby is, you're passionate, actually, about electronic equipment such as radio and transmitters. That's great. Rodrigo Bortolotti from Brazil, many thanks for writing this email to us. It was great. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. Now, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails from around the world. Please stay with us. Thank you. welcome back. I was wondering if I could learn different languages. I know three other languages, but not Romanian. And this name, Rodolf Tocax from Romania, yes. I wish I'm right in pronouncing your name, Rodolf. So, Rodolf from Romania says, dear friends, at first let me introduce myself, okay? I'm a 76-year-old engineer and at the moment a pensioner. In my free time, I like to listen to the radio. This is my hobby since 1959. Till now, I have received QSL cards or verification letters from many radio stations. In a good propagation conditions, I can receive FM radio stations from a distance of 2,000 kilometers. Now, hopefully, I can receive IRIB English radio with good quality. If it is possible, please confirm my reception report with email. Waiting for your answer, and I wish you many success in your work and life. And warmest greetings to you, Rodolf Tocax from Romania, and lots of appreciations to you for writing this email, Rodolf from Romania. And it seems that you have already joined IRIB English Radio. It's nice that you can receive the signals of IRIB English Radio in your region and in your country, Romania, and that's good. So you are a 76-year-old engineer and at the moment a pensioner. We wish you all the best, Rodolf. And many thanks for writing this email to IRIB English Radio. And you have this hobby of listening to different radio stations. And now you are listening to IRIB English Radio. Rodolf, I have a suggestion. Please, please tell us your views about our programs. Please listen to these programs and tell us what you think about these broadcasts in your upcoming emails, of course. And my colleagues will send you EQSL cards. Yes. Before the coronavirus pandemic, we had this tradition in IRIB English Radio to send paper QSL cards to post them around the world. But now, after the hygienic protocols, we are sending our dear listeners around the world EQSL cards. So wait for one of these EQSL cards. And thanks a lot for your reception report. So we are happy that you described IRIB English Radio quality as good. Thanks for that. So we wish you all the best. And also, like you, we wish you many success in your work and life, Rodolf from Romania. Rodolf, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. And here from Sweden, we have an email from Michael Sjöberg. I wish I'm right in pronouncing his name. Michael says, dear voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, my name is Michael and I am a DXer from Sweden. I was listening to your radio on June 18th, 2021 between 2010 and 2020 UTC. Good signal. I listened with my own private antenna in the west coast of Sweden. I attach a small MP3 file. It would be great if you could confirm my reception by a QSL card. Thanks in advance. Have a nice day. Kind regards and 73s. And salam and warmest greetings to you, Michael Sjöberg from Sweden. And we do appreciate you for sending us this email. So you're a DXer, and we are happy that you received the signals of IRIB English Radio in your country, Sweden. As you said, you live in the west coast of Sweden. That's nice. And my colleagues will, as soon as possible, send you EQSL cards, of course. And you said, Michael, that you listened to IRIB English Radio on June 18th, 2021. Why don't you tell us which program you were listening at that time? Yes. In your upcoming emails and letters, please tell us which program or programs you listened and tell us your views about that broadcast or broadcasts. Michael, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon in the future. And now, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with, of course, an email from Richard Cook. welcome back. As I said, here we have an email from Richard Cook from the UK. Richard Cook is one of our regular listeners who says, good afternoon. Hope you are well. It's unfortunate that you couldn't get a QSL card out on the good side. However, an EQSL card is better than nothing. Some of your broadcasts can be a bit unlistenable due to interference or very quiet audio. Hope your technicians can solve this issue. Have a great evening. Yes, salam and warmest greetings to you, Richard Cook from the UK. And as I have said several times during the program, sending these QSL cards was suspended actually, and that's because of the coronavirus hygienic protocols that are international, and we can't send these QSL cards by post, but we can send EQSL cards to our dear listeners, and as you said, it's better than nothing. So you said you had trouble with listening to our radio because of interference or very quiet audio. Of course, I will refer to our technicians and engineers in IRM English Radio and tell them this problem. And of course, our effort always in IRM English Radio is providing the best quality of the programs, audio, or you know, the best kind of broadcast. Richard Cook from the UK, wait for an EQSL card from IRM English Radio. Wish you all the best. And many thanks for reflecting your view about the quality of our programs. Richard Cook from the UK, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And here we come to the end of this week's edition of Listeners Special, the Sunday program, your program. We wish you all the best. Please keep in touch with us, and goodbye.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
the debate.
And welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, after 6 weeks of indirect talks in Vienna, the gap is still wide between signatories of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Now, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the absence of an interim agreement to monitor Iran's nuclear activities could prompt the U.S. to abandon efforts to rejoin a nuclear deal. While Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Saeed Khatibzadeh has said it is the United States that must make its decision and return to the JCPOA by removing illegal sanctions on Iran and effectively fulfilling all of its commitments. Well, stay with us as we take a look at what it all means and the latest on the JCPOA on this debate. Well, we're going to cross over to Vienna and talk to our correspondent on the ground there, Homa Lisky, for the latest. Homa, what's going on?
Yes, Marcia, as you said, there are six round of talks in Vienna have taken place, and there is speculation that there's going to be a seventh round. We still don't know when that's going to happen. Some are suggesting maybe next week, although the sides have not made any announcement. But as that deadline passed on the 24th of June, the technical understanding between Iran and the IAEA expired. It looks like tensions are rising a bit with the remarks you just mentioned there by the U.S. Secretary of State Blinken. And looking at what was said by the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson and his tweet earlier when he mentioned that it's been Iran that's been giving most of the proposals for in the drafting process, that Iran has this steadfast commitment to salvage the deal that the U.S. torpedoed. Political observers have been seeing this as a sign of Iran's political willingness to get this done. And on the other side, the fact that he said that negotiations can't go on forever, what's also been mentioned by Iran's lead negotiator, Abbas Araghchi here, also signifies that Iran's patience is fading. At the same time, U.S. State Department officials and the Secretary of State himself have signaled that these negotiations can't go on forever. This, however, doesn't mean that they've reached a dead end. Until very recently, and in the last round of talks and in the past few days, various participants in these negotiations, including Iran and the U.S., still believe that an agreement is possible. But how is it going to happen when there are still serious differences, as both sides have mentioned? And these differences both include the nuclear commitments, for instance, the issue of advanced centrifuges in Iran, what is going to happen to them once the JCPOA is in place. Also the issue of sequencing, who does what when. Iran saying that it is not changing its position, that it only will act and go back to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all the sanctions and after Iran has verified that sanctions removal, meaning after it is able to sell its oil and to use the international banking system immediately, something that still it looks like the U.S. is not willing to do that in terms of sequencing. And basically, I think what was said by Secretary Blinken is also noteworthy when he said that it is becoming difficult to go back to the original parameters of the JCPOA because, of course, of the advances that Iran is making in its nuclear program since it started, reducing its commitments when the Trump administration withdrew and imposed the maximum pressure policy. What Iran, however, wants is for all of the sanctions to be removed, not just the JCPOA-related sanctions, but those imposed under the Trump administration under other labels. And is the Biden administration willing to remove all of these sanctions? Is it willing to agree to the sequencing that Iran wants? What is going to happen to Iran's advanced centrifuges? Is a return to the original JCPOA possible? These are still very serious questions that need to be answered, although it looks like at least up until this stage that the sides are still willing to continue these talks to see if they can actually reach a conclusion. And we still, of course, don't know when or if Iran is going to extend its technical understanding with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. If that doesn't happen, then the agency would also lose access to the information that's already being collected in Iran and is going to be collected from this stage on.
Thank you so much, Homolinsky, for that update out of Vienna. Now I'd like to welcome to the program founder and executive director of If Americans Knew, Allison Ware, out of Richmond, California. Allison, good to see you. Your take on all of this, Allison. Why is it so difficult for the U.S. to return to an agreement that it says it wants?
Well, the difficulty is that this is a domestic issue for the United States rather than an international issue, as it should be. As I suspect you know, and I hope some of the viewers know, what goes on in the U.S. is that really both parties are largely influenced by the Israel lobby and by Israel itself. So, in a sense, the U.S. is a proxy for Israel in this case. We have Tony Blinken, who's very, has a lifelong connection to Israel. He helped Israel during its onslaught against Gaza in 2014. And this is the U.S. Secretary of State, who's really, I would consider an Israel loyalist. So the Biden administration, while it is different from the Trump administration on many, many policies in the United States, it has changed, Biden himself and his administration have changed very few policies regarding Israel, Palestine, Iran, and the Middle East in general. So the problem is that once again, we have the Israel lobby dominating really the U.S. policies on Iran. And while for the United States, it would be excellent, you know, Americans want peace with Iran. We don't want all of these Middle East wars. Surveys continue to show that the American public across the political spectrum does not want peace wars, does not want this kind of friction and hostility. We have the Israel lobby promoting these kind of policies that really are on behalf of Israel. So I'd say that's the biggest stumbling block to this.
Okay. Well, let me welcome my next guest, Ada Leesburg from the Executive Intelligence Review. Bill Jones, thank you so much for being with us. Bill, hopefully you heard what Allison said, that really on the surface, the Biden administration says it wants to do things differently and wants to take a different course than the Trump administration. But the reality on the ground seems to be the opposite, especially when it comes to Iran and dealing with this JCPOA. Your perspective, and if you agree, why is that the reason?
Well, obviously, I think that the United States, probably the Biden administration, would like to have some kind of agreement similar to the JCPOA to prevent a nuclear race in the Middle East, which would be the alternative to that. The question is, are they ready to go back to the table on the basis of the agreement that was signed, which Trump left? It seems to me that there are a lot of caveats that they have there, and that they're really trying, in one sense, to up the ante, to actually try and get more than what had been promised and what had been decided on during the former agreements. The other aspect of this thing, of course, or two aspects, is one is the new Iranian government. Are they really prepared to do that as well? This is still not totally clear. But also on the U.S. side, there's a new Israeli government. Now, obviously, they shouldn't be a party to these talks. They aren't a party to these talks, but they are certainly a factor in any decision taken by the U.S., and we really don't know what opinion they have of the JCPOA or even of an extended JCPOA that the Biden administration may be moving toward. And I think a lot of that has to be clarified, and that's why you're seeing a lot of back off and interruptions in getting back to the table and getting back to a deal on the part of the administration here.
Let me see, Allison. Can you hear me? Because we did have a little technical difficulties. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well, Allison. Yeah, your overall take. I mean, Iran's foreign ministry is saying that they never left the deal to begin with. So the demand by the United States for Tehran to return to the deal first is actually not logical at all, because they're technically still in the deal, but it was the United States that left it. So in your perspective, where does it go from here?
it's true that this was the United States had signed what's really an obligatory format. It was binding under U.S. Constitutional law. So what the Trump administration abandoned the deal, it was actually, I feel, violating U.S. law, certainly the types of things that are considered obligatory under our Constitution. It's difficult now because the Biden administration does want to avoid open hostilities. The deal was actually quite good for the United States. It's beneficial to Israel. It exposed Iran to really intrusive inspections, but Iran, I think, with common sense, did agree to the deal. So now the impasse is, I think, once again, sad. I'm a very patriotic American. I have children here and grandchildren here. I want the best for my nation. But I feel that U.S. policies are really damaging the potential for peace, and they're the real problem now in getting another suitable deal that will prevent a Middle East nuclear race. Even though, you know, again, it's never acknowledged that Israel itself has at least 100 nuclear weapons and may have several hundred nuclear weapons. So there are already nuclear weapons in the Middle East. That's just never discussed when we talk about Iran.
What about that bill? I mean, if we look at the situation, one would think that if the U.S. says that this deal is really effective, which it had said before. We saw the Trump administration said that it was an unfair deal even for the United States. So at this point in time, why do you think that Washington is trying to expand on the original agreement now? I mean, they are have tried to include anything from dealing with missile programs to now other centrifuges, advanced centrifuges, of course, and that Iran has worked on after the U.S. left the agreement. So, you know, that Tehran did not go against the agreement. So what's your analysis of all of this?
Well, I think they're hedging because of the fact that there is this, or has been this hiatus in the agreement. And I think there's a real will to get an agreement. But that they're playing hardball in one sense and trying to up the ante before they come and really sign on to a deal, and I think that's causing big problems for getting it back into place. The U.S. did leave the agreement, and in diplomatic terms, if they want to come back, they should come back to that agreement rather than trying to move the goalposts as they're re-entering here. There may also be certain people in the administration who are not happy with that agreement and would like to have a change, but I think that's going to cause more difficulties in getting any kind of an agreement. So, you know, judging from their own national interests, the best thing would be to go back to that agreement. If they want to try and work on something else with regard to other questions with Iran, that could very well be discussed in some format. But it seems to me that if they got this in place, that would be a stable basis on which other things could be discussed. But trying to throw it in at the last minute to get an agreement, I think it's not going to fly.
Well, Allison, now Iran's foreign ministry has said that the revival of the nuclear agreement is possible if Washington stopped using sanctions as a negotiating leverage. And we know that the Trump administration use what it calls the maximum pressure campaign. But it seems that the Biden administration is using the same technique, although the wording isn't there. They're not talking about maximum pressure, but definitely they're continuing to keep the pressure on. So what is the difference, and what would be the incentive for Iran to even try to continue this when they never kept their word to begin with?
Well, I think for all of us, best thing would be to have some sort of agreement that ultimately that's the bottom line, even if it's as flawed as this one may end up being. I think it's certainly beneficial to have some sort of agreement and not consider continuing this kind of saber rattle. The Biden administration is grappling with the fact that Democrats are now, they're in control of the legislative branch, but it's very close. It's very close. So they have to deal with the fact that the Republican Party has been even more captured by the Israel model. and will portray any Biden move as overly conciliatory and directed by Iran. So they have to overcome that. They also have to overcome the hawks within the Democratic Party, who've been very powerful, even though the grassroots in the previous election clearly supported people like Tulsi Gabbard and a number of other people that were calling for peaceful types of actions and were not hawks. That's where the Democratic voters were. But the Democratic leadership decided that we would get Joe Biden, who's much more of a hawk, has a long history of being a hawk, and that's now the administration that's in charge. Despite all of that, I expect that the U.S. will finally take some of the actions necessary to procure some sort of deal. I'm unhappy that it's taking them so long to do it. I think they'll keep delaying longer, but I think that eventually something can happen and probably will.
What about that bill? Your take. Do you think at the end of the day the U.S. is going to return to the deal?
I think somehow they have got to remain a part of that process and not let that go to hell in a handbasket, and that therefore they're going to have to find some kind of compromise that can be acceptable also to Iran for creating and reinstituting the JCPOA in some form.
And Allison, I mean, possible scenarios in your opinion, if a deal is reached, if the United States returns, and on the other side, if it does not?
Well, if it does not, then we have increased tensions and possibly outright warfare, which would be disastrous for, I mean, also disastrous for Americans. I think that is, you know, potentially possible if some sort of deal isn't procured. On the other hand, if there is a deal, it would at least quiet things down a little bit. I think it would help.
And sorry about that, because we're having some technical difficulties with the audio from Allison. But Bill, at the end of the day, how much of an influence do you see Israel is having and putting pressure on Washington to actually continue to try to play hardball and perhaps not even return to the JCPOA?
Well, Israel is obviously not the determining factor. They are a factor that's taken into consideration by this administration, as it was by the former, or most of the former administrations as well. But they're not the determining factor. The basic idea, of course, is the national interest comes first. If Israel feels threatened, there are things the United States can do to ease that with regard to their own supply of military hardware, our alliances that can be strengthened so that the Israelis don't feel threatened by an agreement between the U.S. and Iran and other countries. But I think they are definitely a factor. They'll keep it on the side of their eye to see how the Israelis are reacting. But I think the real problem is the attitude of the administration itself really that we call the shots, we make the rules, and somehow other countries have got to fall in line with that.
Okay.
And that is the biggest problem.
Okay. Allison, hopefully I can get you 1 minute on this. Your take. You heard Bill that said actually the priority, of course, is national interests come before the Israeli interests. Your take on the influence of Israel in all of this and trying to keep the United States out of this agreement.
Well, influence, I feel, by Israel is pretty much decisive in most cases, sometimes moderated a bit. So it may end up that the U.S. will have to give Israel more money. We already give Israel over $10 million per day. On behalf of Israel, we expend $19 million per day. So to get this deal and keep Israel happy and to get Israel to allow us to make